speaking on the issues that impact. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Welcome back. Second hour here, this live broadcast. We'll be joined in a few minutes by independent State Department correspondent in Washington, D.C., Sam Husseini. He's going to join us for a very pithy discussion. I'm looking forward to that, really following up on some of the key points. Obviously, we had another slate of stories lined up with Sam that we're going to discuss, but the breaking news of the imminent strikes by Iran against Israel, certainly this trumps all other stories. We'll move to that first with Sam to get his take on it. Certainly, he's been in the briefings at the U.S. State Department, so he'll be able to tell us what the atmosphere has been like this week and some of the things that he's encountered. Great, valuable commentary that we get from Sam. Really appreciate it. He'll join us in a few minutes. And of course, tremendous analysis by Yusuf Mowry. He's an award-winning journalist based in the Middle East from Yemen. His work is renowned. He writes for a number of excellent publications. We're very privileged to be able to speak to him. And he's also on the front line of one of the most important parts of the sort of global conflict right now at the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, there at the tip, the southern southwest tip of Yemen. So hotly contested area. Certainly that's going to play big. Let's say, for instance, if Iran chooses to close the Straits of Hormuz, if escalations do rise, I mean, Iran holds quite a few cards with regards to the United States. And as I was talking with Syrian Girl in the first hour, the U.S. Doesn't have that much leverage, not compared to the leverage that Iran has. So what kind of deals could Iran get with the leverage that they have like that? And the answer is there's quite a bit that they can do. So the position of the U.S. is weakening in the region. The position of Iran is strengthening. The position of Israel is weakening, not only in the region, but globally as well. The support is hemorrhaging at the UN level and even further afield. That's just a reality, ladies and gentlemen. That's where the world is at right now, especially as a result of what's happened in the last 6 months. These cases at the ICJ, we'll also cover with Sam Husseini, are not insequential, because what they do provide the baseline for another policy, which very well may come down the pipeline, and maybe in not too long of time. That is sanctions against Israel. They tried to sanction Russia, but being the world's largest basket commodity producer in the world, we're talking about oil, gas, aluminium, titanium, precious metals, all sorts of things, nitrates, all those things that Russia produces and exports, makes it very difficult to sanction or shut the economy down. It's so well diversified in terms of energy and commodities that it's almost impossible, in fact. But not with a country like Israel. A couple of key sanctions could effectively cripple the country. We saw what Yemen was able to achieve by enforcing a blockade on naval traffic destined to Israel, or providing material support for the state of Israel. And you look how that played out. Yemen, a small country, extremely poor country, but somewhat determined and fairly well equipped for the operations that it was carrying out, was able to bring trade to a standstill and bring the United States to the negotiation table. And more or less, it looks like the United States is dealing with Yemen, saying we're going to remove the terrorist designation that we put on Ansar Allah, aka the Houthis, in exchange for a little leniency on maritime traffic, if you can believe that. Since when does the U.S. go cap in hand to a country like Yemen? The answer is never. We live in strange times, ladies and gentlemen. That's why we're bringing on the experts to talk about these key stories. Now, we will connect with Sam Husseini shortly, but I want to bring a couple of important data points in. And one of those is, and I know some of you are biting your tongue if you thought you were going to thought about buying gold a couple of months ago, but for whatever reason you didn't. Now you're really regretting it. $2,400 an ounce, folks. So there's a rush on gold. So there it is. It broke the $2,000 barrier and didn't just break it, it shattered it. $2,431 per ounce. That's probably going to go up. You're talking about 4% for the week, 16% for the year. This is the highest run on gold we have seen in decades. So it's broken its all-time high price. So listen, if you're holding dollars right now, you're probably better off going out and buying gold. It's that simple. So, I mean, if you're lucky to get a hold of it, it's probably going to become more and more difficult to get a hold of. But we're going to recommend certainly a good strategy if you want to get into gold right now is through numismatics. In other words, coins, Liberty dollars, British sovereigns. These are highly liquid, easy to transport, and you can buy them more or less at spot price. So that's just our general recommendation. And what we're saying is exactly what every other gold dealer is probably going to tell you anyway. Just Google it on the internet and you'll hear the same thing. But so it's never a bad time to get into gold. We're not selling anything here. I'm just talking from the point of the viewpoint of small investors everywhere, many of whom are our listeners. People who frequent this show are people who will say and do these exact things. Listen, folks, this is just historic. But what does this mean? Okay, when gold goes up, it means that the dollar's in trouble. It means that inflation is serious, and inflation is serious. The other thing that it means, it might signal a shot up in oil prices. These things always correlate. So I think this summer, we're going to see an oil crisis. And look at that. As if to made to order. We've got tensions with Iran in the Middle East. We've got World War III on the cusp. So you add this to inflation, the gold spike. Now we have the threat of war, the threat of the Straits of Hormuz being shut. Even if they shut it for a week, it would shoot oil up past $150 a barrel. Okay, what does that mean? It means you're going to be paying more at the pump. But it also means that all these sort of precious metals are going to skyrocket, including silver. So bad news for the dollar, bad news for gas prices, good news for conservative small investors, probably good news for the big funds. They're all over this right now. In fact, they're probably going to leverage and drive it, to be honest, by the end of it. Good news for Bitcoin, that's breaking all records as well. So yes, fear of missing out, big time FOMO for a lot of people who missed the boat over the last 3 or 4 months. Listen, we're just going to say it because someone's asked to say it. This is what's happening, folks. These are all the signs for a potential collapse of the US dollar. When I'm talking about a collapse, not a global collapse, but certainly a collapse in value, a dumping of treasury bills, all these things that you see that might coincide with a war, a major war. So we don't want these things to happen, yet they're happening. So you out there, you're going to react and do what you need to do to survive. And certainly people are doing that right now. Pay attention to those pundits or those people in the world of finance that you trust, because now is the time to be active in moving your assets around accordingly. Because let's face it, the US dollar is highly volatile and maybe not the best place really to have all your money right now. That's just us saying that. In fact, we're not saying anything different than every other financial pundit right now, worth their salt. So again, this is not a money show. We're just commenting on historic breakthroughs on gold. Unbelievable. I hope we don't see $150 per barrel on oil, or $200 per barrel for that matter, but certainly the signs are very concerning. Let's take a break right now with TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
There was a plan on the British side to immediately after the victory over Germany to continue the war, to push the weakened Soviet Union back over over backwards. Yeah, so that is something that is not well known. That plan has been, you could find it on the internet, and then it's off and on sometimes again. It's very difficult. It's not long. It's something like, if I recall correctly, something of 30 pages, I would say. I read it.
The Soviets had this coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948. And that appeared as the Soviets really was pushing forward, and they thought that this means that we have to start an alliance against the Soviets. And that was NATO became.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on Today's News Talk, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio.
News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're in hour number two of this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us here. And again, the top story trumps all headlines today, which is why we're allocating a lot of focus and energy to this. U.S. Officials saying here, telling CBS News that Iran is ready to strike multiple targets within Israel in the next 24 to 48 hours. Again, this timeline that they're citing here, it's flexible depending on what goes on the diplomatic front. We'll see. There's a lot of activity, I would imagine, going on behind the scenes. To give us a little bit of insight on what might be going on behind the scenes, as well as comment on a number of other stories which we had slated for today, I want to welcome on to the program independent State Department correspondent and journalist Sam Husseini is joining us on the live link right now from the United States. Sam, welcome to the program.
Trick.
So things have developing quite quickly on this front, Sam, and a lot of people are very concerned, very worried about escalation. Will people be able to control this escalation? A lot of people are also concerned that Israel might have an incentive to draw the United States into a direct confrontation with the Islamic Republic of Iran. These are all concerns that a lot of people have right now. I know you've got your ear to the ground on this. Where is Washington right now on this issue? What are the main concerns? Are there people in place that can avert the worst possible scenario that we're thinking of here? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, U.S. stated goals and actual goals aren't the same. You know, they say they want stability and so on, but they end up, putting forward a series of policies that end up doing the exact opposite of what they say that they want. And this happens over and over again. There are a number of benefits of, you know, even putting out a false story of an escalation. It draws attention away from the actual carnage continuing to go on in Gaza. There's obviously concerted effort underway to make it to frame it as a low intensity warfare conflict at this point. That is basically to normalize a genocide that's continuing to be perpetrated. So Israel has a number of interests in terms of, you know, acting as though it's the victim, acting as though Iran might strike it directly. And the U.S. might share those interests. That doesn't preclude the possibility that Iran could actually do that. It's obviously been provoked. Most recently with a strike in Syria on its official diplomatic assemblies there. So I'm a little reluctant to get drawn into what's actually going on, because we're literally sort of being spun by anticipation in large part coming out of Washington, which may or may not have actual basis. I mean, you got to be reminded of, Washington was claiming that Russia was going to invade Ukraine. And a lot of people said, oh, no, that's, not going to happen because Washington is lying 110% of the time. And Washington does lie a hell of a lot of the time. But in that particular case, that did actually happen. So I think those are some of the parameters to keep in mind here.
Yeah, I think you're right. The big point there, I think the big important point that you've made is Israel, through this provocation by hitting the Iranian embassy in Damascus just last week, by doing this and creating this new escalation ladder, they've totally taken the focus off of Gaza. And as you said, Sammy, the horrific crimes against humanity, the genocide that's been taking place over the last 6 months, that's all too convenient, a very canny move on Israel's part, but also potentially a very risky move if they're not able to manage the fallout on this. So in terms of the appetite for war right now, let's just talk about this real quick, Sam. Election cycle, Biden administration. Is a war with Iran good or bad for a Biden reelection campaign? Good or bad for a Trump challenge? What are your thoughts on the political dynamics here?
I mean, in perverse ways, it's probably good for both. If you're, an incumbent, a sitting president, and you're in a war, that usually helps your numbers. Is a perverse logic in U.S. politics the last couple of decades. I don't think that used to be the case. And, Vietnam, it actually hurt LBJ. So it partially depends on the level of protest against it. You have seen substantial protests against it, and you've seen the Biden administration at least pretend to care about Palestinian civilians in large part, presumably because of concerns about domestic and election ramifications from parts of the Democratic Party as well as others. Trump seemingly has continuously, chopped at the bit against Iran. He pulled the plug on the Iran deal, which the Biden administration never put back. As I've long argued, there's effectively a complicity, a collusion going on between the Biden and Trump administrations in terms of core actual policies. This would be an incredible boon if there were a serious, credible candidate who was anti-war, but unfortunately that doesn't yet exist. RFK Jr. talks out of every side of his mouth, and Jill Stein has run for the presidency several times and not been able to crack low single digits. So part of what's driving this is the inability of anti-establishment forces in the United States, and I have my Vote Pact project, which is advocating this, to fix that, to have an anti-establishment candidate, getting support from both the left and right against war, against infringements on civil liberties, and so on. That's the solution that's sitting there that forces have not been able to organize around in the United States in order to help stave off this perverse dynamic that happens with the two-party duopoly, where they in effect log roll their way potentially into a wider war here.
Sure. And I know breaking news just on the two-party duopoly, your thesis there is absolutely proven by the renewal of the FISA warrant bill. So warrantless wiretapping on Americans extended. I mean, if you need any better example of both parties absolutely in the tank for all the wrong reasons, there you go. That exactly. Thing could have been killed by anybody, but they've decided to keep it going, right. Sam. Unbelievable.
Right. And one or both of the parties go before their bases, tell them that they're going to, that they're going to fix a problem like that, that they're going to, drain the swamp, that they're going to stand up to the deep state. And then they turn around and they get an alleged briefing, as the Speaker of the House allegedly did, and then he pretends that they've got actual evidence or something. So I'm going to renege on all of this. And here we go again. Civil liberties get flushed down the toilet again. While we're facing an alleged imminent attack against Israel by Iran, how convenient. So a hell of a lot to be skeptical of, and every reason for people to finally break out of the corrupt duopoly.
You were talking about there, the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and that he was given this national security briefing from a SCIF, a special enclosed facility where lawmakers are given top secret briefings from the great and the good from the intelligence services. A lot of people will say, Sam, I don't know if you agree or not, but it's very easy for intelligence operatives to show what they are, you know, reports or maybe that might be true, might not be true, or it's something they piece together, and to shock and to scare the lawmaker, in this case, into renewing an unconstitutional piece of legislation. I mean, that's what Daniel McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute is saying, and others are saying this as well. But the mainstream media, Sam, are saying, no, what the CIA show you in a skiff is sacrosanct. It must be true. The ticking bomb. You know, the Jack Bauer 24, the ticking bomb, the things we need to do to get that information. We really need to suspend all these rights and obstacles to, you know, stopping the bad guys. Right. What do you know about this? Is this possible that the deep state could be, you know, kind of manipulating the process here in this case?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely possible that the deep state could be manipulating the process and could be feeding lawmakers fake or deceitful information. I don't know a great deal about it in exactly this context, but it's analogous to the context when you talk about the ticking time bomb and the Jack Bauer thing. The rationale for torture is similar. We got to torture people in order to get this information, and then the liberal response to that is torture doesn't work. The reality is that torture works to produce false but useful information. And that was done during the buildup of the Iraq War, when they tortured people, or they had the Egyptians torture a person named al-Libi into saying that Iraq and al-Qaeda were working together. And then Colin Powell goes before the UN and saying, we know that al-Qaeda and Iraq are working together. So the CIA effectively lined up false but useful, a false confession, effectively, in order to justify the policies. So you could very well be seeing an analogous situation here in terms of justifying mass surveillance.
So right now, let's go shift gears a little bit, unless you want to close up or have any further comments on this potential escalation now between. Oh, by the way, I'm just going to ask you if Iran does hit targets inside Israel, how much pressure will be placed on the Biden administration by the hawks from both parties that they need to retaliate against Iran? That the U.S. must stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel. And at that point, is that a dangerous kind of road to tread down? Or do you think that the Joint Chiefs at that more, say, tactical level that have war-gamed out an exchange with Iran and seen it to be a losing endeavor in the end, talking about the RAND Corporation and others, that might show restraint in that case? How do you think Washington will behave if Iran does come good on what it says it's going to do? What do you think?
I'm not a military expert in terms of the war gaming. You would expect then the Iranians would close the Straits of Hormuz, and things could, then Hezbollah would escalate their activities, presumably. So there's a lot of different dimensions to this, but ultimately, if you really want to war game this out to the max, we're talking about the fact that Israel has a nuclear weapons arsenal and Iran doesn't, and the United States refuses to acknowledge that Israel has a nuclear weapons arsenal. Netanyahu, that could be part of what's driving Netanyahu to seem to be, what's euphemistically called, provocative and or aggressive and seeming to want a wider war, that ultimately he's got this ace in the hole if it totally goes to that. It is important to bear that in mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope that there's more reasons for the U.S. to put pressure on Israel to show restraint than there are for the other way around. I personally think that the U.S. military is in a very weak position, not as strong as it has been in the past in the Middle East. Therefore, they would be tremendously exposed should things escalate past that level. And I don't think that's something that Washington wants to think about managing at this particular time. That's just me being optimistic there. And that might include the Biden administration making a phone call to Tel Aviv on this. And certainly it seems like there's a little bit of friction between Joe Biden and Netanyahu or the White House and Israel. It's not the same sort of lovey-dovey, we're all in for you no matter what, till death do us part, all this stuff, Sam. There is friction because there's political fallout from the last 6 months. And I even think it's being felt at the highest levels of the Democratic Party establishment. What do you think? Is there a potential for a change in the relationship at all, or at least a little bit more restraint from the U.S. Right. on Israel?
Yeah, but it could also be simple posturing for electoral reasons by the Biden administration. They certainly haven't changed their policy in terms of arming Israel, in terms of effectively giving it, political cover. They did allow the one finally a ceasefire resolution to go through at the Security Council by abstaining, but then they immediately undermined it by saying it was non-binding, which is ridiculous. So in terms of core policy, there has not been a change. So, I always distinguish between, actual, show me what you do. I don't care what you say, if it's just simply rhetorical posturing. And ultimately Israel, one could see a scenario whereby they put somebody else in who's more palatable than Netanyahu and effectively continue the same policy, someone who's not so brazenly obnoxious. But on the other hand, it how else does this stop other than as a first step, Netanyahu leaving? There are different ways of looking at it, but I would say, show me what you're doing. I don't care what you're saying, or what you read in the New York Times about how angry Biden is, or whatever it is.
Yeah, certainly, I think there's scope for. I wish Sam. The UN Security Council would have an emergency meeting. I mean, if reports are correct, Sam, communiques between the Iranians and the Americans suggest that a condemnation by the UN Security Council against Israel for destroying an Iranian embassy in Damascus, that would go a long way to de-escalation and have high political value for Iran and for its allies. Seems to be, that's the easiest solution to de-escalation, Sam, but I'm not seeing it. And this is the problem. Is there anybody on the Security Council that can make this happen?
Yeah, that would be a really important way to deal with this. And there are really interesting historical analogies to stuff like that. For example, few people noted when South Africa filed their case before the ICJ on the Genocide Convention, Hamas stopped firing towards Tel Aviv for a month until the hearings were done. And then the order was given, and then Israel violated the order, and then Hamas resumed striking towards Tel Aviv, like that day or the next day. It was really remarkable. You also had the case, I don't want to go too far in a rabbit hole with you, but this is a fascinating case, where during the Iran hostage crisis back in 1979, Senator James Aberesk, who's probably the most radical senator in U.S. history, at least since World War II, Arab American, he attempted to broker a deal. Whereby the Senate would announce that it would be having hearings about Iranian grievances towards the United States, backing of the Shah, torture that took place under the Shah, all of these nefarious U.S. activities that happened for decades. And then in return, it was a three-step process, and then the Iranians would release the hostages, and then the hearings would be held. And Iran said, if you do that, we can find a diplomatic, if we are able to communicate, if we are able to air these grievances, we can resolve this in a reasonable fashion. And that didn't happen. So instead, you had the, you know, insane skullduggery of the October surprise, where you had the Reaganites go behind everybody's back and make a deal and hold the hostages until the day that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. So, you know, let's have an open process that gets us peace and not a derangement. And to his shame, Carter turned down that deal. Ebrest tried to get it done. He, you know, he was a very influential senator in his own, you know, real maverick sort of way. But the Carter administration stopped it from getting done because they were trying to, you know, be tough and all of this nonsense. Well, it ended up costing Carter the presidency. Thank you very much.
Well, now that you've brought this up, Sam, this set of circumstances of the Carter administration, the state of the U.S. economy, the state of the foreign policy predicaments at the time, the type of electoral contest, the contrast, there are some similarities right now today. And what's to say, Sam, that if would Donald Trump be in a position to pull some similar sort of stunt that Reagan did at that time, something to do with this current hostilities? Because wouldn't the one Biden or Trump to appear to be the peacemaker to diffuse the escalation to a wider conflict would be, you know, huge amount of kudos in terms of, you know, campaigning there. I wouldn't rule out Biden looking at the hawkishness of Trump on this issue and then maybe holding back a solution to present to the public and diffusing it, and then thus getting a whole wave of support. But it's hugely risky, of course. Do you see similarities between the 80 election and now?
It's possible. And what you, I hadn't thought of it until you said it, but that's really fascinating. I mean, in the context of 1980, you had Bush, who had been CIA director, as his running mate. And, you know, all kinds of apparatchiks around his circles, including Bill Casey, who would become CIA director. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot of mechanisms for doing that kind of skullduggery. Whether, you know, Trump has that in his immediate circus, I mean, it's possible. I mean, you could have Kushner, you know, go and talk to some buddies in the Gulf who would have some contacts potentially. You know, I certainly, in terms of ethics, I certainly wouldn't put anything past you know, cadre around Trump. That's for sure.
Yeah. There's some possibilities there. There's some possibilities there. And likewise on the Biden side, that he could engineer some sort of a similar outcome for the incumbent. I think this is all definitely up for grabs at the moment. The bottom line, of course, for all of us here out in the world is we want to do everything possible to avert World War III, least of all the people in the Middle East who are going to be bearing the brunt of that conflict initially anyway. But moving on, just got a couple of minutes left and we're going to break in a couple of minutes, Sammy, but what about the ICJ case, Nicaragua v. Germany? All reports are, indications are, it's not looking good for Germany. This is a potential public relations disaster for Germany, for Olaf Scholz. What do you know so far on how this is going to flesh out?
Sure. And we should emphasize that this case happened early this week and that the speculation around Iran limited the coverage of this. And the crux of the case was that not only, as South Africa has accused, is Israel committing genocide, but that Germany, in parentheses, and other states are aiding and abetting it and are themselves in violation of their treaty obligations under the Genocide Convention. So Nicaragua put forward, it wasn't quite as polished, you might say, as the South Africa case, but it was still a very, very substantial case that Nicaragua put forward, you know, drawing attention to Germany arming Israel and their treaty obligations under the Genocide Convention, and so on and so forth. It was a very robust case. Germany, in its response, basically said, it has been, you know, one of our core reasons of state has been to support Israel because of the Holocaust. This is an insane statement. It has nothing to do with international law. It has nothing to do. It's actually empathetical to international law. The phrase that they used is just raison d'être, if I'm pronouncing it right, which I'm probably not, is basically just saying, you know, we're doing this for political reasons. usually interpreted as for reasons of state in terms of one's self-interest, but they're saying, no, we're doing this for the interest of Israel. And they went through their litany of that their own domestic laws, prohibit, arming a state that would use it illegally, as if that counts for anything. And they also try to argue that this case from World War II involving a dispute over gold between Italy and Albania was relevant because the relevant country wasn't party to the case, meaning Israel's not a party to this case, and therefore just sort of on technical grounds. That probably will not hold up because there's a pending case with Israel. And again, Germany is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and it has agreed that the ICJ can adjudicate disputes in that. And that's exactly what's going on here. They are aiding and abetting genocide, and they are obviously failing to prevent genocide. And so Nicaragua has a strong case.
So would that, in effect, be a precedent for all the other stakeholders who've been arming Israel, the United States included, if this goes that way? Does that open the door for more legislation, more legal action?
It could. The problem with the United States is that the U.S. has a reservation on Article 9 of the Genocide Convention, which allows for it to be adjudicated by the ICJ. Now, I don't know what happens if you get a ruling from the ICJ in this case, if that then begins to trump that reservation by the United States. So again, we're pushing the envelope here. You have not seen a case like this actually adjudicated before the ICJ. It has been threatened before in the case of Bosnia, but it has not actually gone forward before.
Well, this is very interesting indeed, and quite amazing. Again, a smaller country from the so-called global south running point on this effort, certainly showing up everybody else in the northern hemisphere. So listen, we'll keep an eye on this, of course. And again, we appreciate your observations, your insights on these really important stories. Sam Husseini, independent journalist, also independent correspondent at the U.S. State Department. Really appreciate all of your hard work. And do visit Sam Husseini's Substack, subscribe. Excellent journalism there. He'll keep you up to date on what's important going on in Washington. Sam, really appreciate you joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you, Patrick.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Sam Husseini. Let's take a break right now with TNT, Today's News Talk. And when we come back, we will close out the news roundup for the week here on Friday. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stick around. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most. To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My arm helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
Yeah, okay. This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you!
Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, welcome back to the program. We're in the final segment, the final hour here on TNT, today's News Talk. Very heavy ending of the week. Like I said before in the opening segment, folks, we've all known about this. We've thought about this. People have done Hollywood blockbusters anticipating this very moment. It's on the front of our minds. Every single one of us who does journalism and analysis is what will happen when that moment comes, when Iran and when Israel and when the United States gets dragged in as well against Iran. What's that going to look like? How the market's going to react? How are governments going to react? What's it going to look like globally? And we're starting to see it now. We've done a pretty good job, I think, of sketching out a lot of these important factors for you over the course of these 2 hours, which makes this a very valuable broadcast indeed. And to bring on award-winning journalists as well, to bring them in to comment on such important breaking stories, and some of the top analysts like Miriam Sussli and also Yusuf Mowry, and of course Sam Husseini, makes it all the more important that we're able to keep up doing the work that we do as independent media and broadcasting here on TNT, Today's News Talk. Another reason why you should be supporting this network in any way you can. One of the things that you can do that doesn't cost anything, in fact, is to share the content on TNT. You just go to tntradio.live, go to listen back section for our show, for instance. There's an audio and a video archive, which is kept up almost daily. In fact, you can share all of these episodes as well. They're reposted on other platforms as well, including YouTube, Rumble, Odyssey, BitChute, and so forth. So get the content out there. This is especially this broadcast today. This is extremely valuable broadcast. Big hello to everybody in the TNT chat community. I see a few usual suspects in there. Appreciate it. I hope you guys find this commentary and analysis, the type of news that we're bringing you, valuable in terms of the independent media sphere. I know you're not tuning into the mainstream media. If you were, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be listening to me right now. But you're really throwing it in with the independent media and the alternative media. And I think we're definitely leading the way on that here at TNT. I'd like to think on this show we're doing our little part in helping to educate and inform people around the world, but also people from government and people in institutions in different countries have reached out to us at different junctures over the last couple of years to say they appreciate the work that we do, and that our commentary and some of the interviews that we do, the analysis, has also factored in to their evaluations of situations in terms of policy and so forth. It's the same with the New York Times and some of these other bigger papers of record. So why shouldn't it be the same with independent media? And in fact, it is. We've gotten that sort of feedback from people, and it does very much encourage us to go on and do more and to keep going. It's a very important time right now. Now, we've got a couple of minutes left, and let's focus on one of the big issues. And how did this all start, folks? How did this all start? Would any of this be happening if there wasn't an ongoing genocide in Gaza? And I know if you're tired of hearing about that now, if you're tired of it, if you've got fatigue, genocide fatigue, let me tell you, it's not as bad as the people living in Gaza. Imagine having to dig your little baby brother or sister out from under tons of concrete blocks, knowing that you've left them there for a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe more, because you just couldn't get anybody to help dig them out. And that, unfortunately, has been the situation for the last 6 months in Gaza, for instance. So what elicited this reaction by Israel, this sort of weapons-free carpet bombing, this mass slaughter on an industrial scale that we've all witnessed on our smartphones and televisions? And one of those, of course, is lies, damn lies, and propaganda. and our media are so culpable in this disaster, this human disaster, that it needs to be called out. And to run some of the reports that they did in the aftermath of October 7th, that were blatantly fake stories. Nobody asked for any qualification on them. They just ran them. Pretty soon, everyone's repeating the same thing, 40 beheaded babies and so forth. Every politician in the West and the Israelis, of course, themselves, government officials were parroting all this stuff that Hamas committed mass rape, Hamas beheaded 40 babies. It turns out now, upon further examination, investigations, and journalism in Israel, Israeli press have admitted that none of these things actually happened, or there's no evidence to suggest that they actually happened. But so many people believe they happened, that it created the atmosphere and the motivation for revenge. Revenge against the Palestinian people in Gaza for what the Israelis believed and what our mainstream media told everybody were the horrific atrocities of October 7th. Am I going down a controversial path here? Am I? Well, listen, we have feelings about these things, strong emotional feelings, but we also have facts. And as some people infamously say, my facts don't care about your feelings. And let's just be frank, ladies and gentlemen. It's a day that will live in infamy. The surprise attack of October 7th, 2023. It's going to be one of those dates. And at the time, let's be clear about the history. This was launched by the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza. And it initiated a series of events that have transformed the geopolitical landscape of the Middle East and beyond. And for the Palestinian people, the humanitarian crisis continues to deteriorate as onlookers bear witness to the abject horrors of Israel's relentless siege and barbaric bombing campaigns of the Gaza Strip. And while it's important to acknowledge that all aspects of this historic incident, it's also vital to see as a testament all these things that happened to the sheer power of propaganda in the 21st century. At first glance, all this imagery from October 7th, it appeared to be horrific and conclusive. We were told this is what happened. Israeli kibbutz homes destroyed, replete with bullet holes everywhere. We saw the footage. And scores of burnt out automobiles. You remember those images? I do. But they were without context at the time. Later, we came to find out that these images represented something very different, a very different narrative than the one we were told at that time on October 7th. It's incredible how things turn once the context is established. There's also the unthinkable video of revelers attending a rave, panicking and fleeing on foot, the Supernova Music Festival. That was actually happening in a field adjacent to an Israeli military outpost, just a few minutes away. And that was adjacent to a massive prison wall and security fencing encasing the Gaza Strip. A lot of people don't know that. Yes, indeed, they chose to have a rave right next to one of the most highly securitized zones in the world. Maybe not a great decision in hindsight, but nobody really talks about that very much. And we can add to this the alleged atrocities committed by Hamas. And I say alleged because many of them have actually been debunked, and blame has been attributed by the Israeli mainstream media, talking about the Times of Israel, talking about Ynet, I'm talking about Haaretz. Blame has been attributed in these cases, and other media outlets have reported on this, to the IDF themselves. In fact, it is believed by many of the top analysts and reporters who have closely studied the data and what happened on October 7th, that the overwhelming majority, in fact, of civilian casualties on October 7th on the Israeli side were committed at the hands of the Israeli military. They panicked, they went weapons free, they invoked the Hannibal Directive and killed many of their own people. But that's not how it was reported at the time. But now we know that's the case. That's exactly what happened. And we can all say, yes, this alleged evidence and the further litany, second and third hand witness claims, anecdotal accounts by the Israeli government, by Zaka, this is the White Helmets equivalent in Israel, search and rescue organization, turned out to be incredibly corrupt, involved in all sorts of scandals. Anyway, they were the main source for the Western media. So all this, these harrowing tales of butchery and rank debauchery, including 40 beheaded babies, babies in ovens, babies hung from clotheslines. Did you see that report from the Israeli side? I certainly did. Very embarrassing indeed, because it actually didn't happen. And people admitted it after the fact. Mass rape of Israeli women on October 7th, still no evidence, despite a UN effort and a special fact-finding team that was deployed to Israel, came back with no evidence. Primula Patton, we talked about it on this program. And this claim, 1,400 Israelis, the worst slaughter since the Holocaust. That didn't happen. They quickly lowered that number to 1,200. And among those 1,200, a number of soldiers, combatants included there, between 300 and 400. We add to that scores of police, Shin Bet officers, armed settlers, militia. And pretty soon we're down to an extremely small number of potential civilians allegedly killed by Hamas. The truth is we don't know the full numbers. We can only go by a process of elimination and deductive reasoning, looking at the data and the evidence to try to get close to the truth. And that's the best we can do, is get close to the truth. Only Israel could do a definitive investigation and give us the absolute truth. Based on all forensic evidence, all reporting, synthesizing all of that, it would take a major commission. But it doesn't seem like they're going to do that, because the results of such a commission, the results would absolutely obliterate the Israeli narrative on October 7th. So pro-Israeli pundits and politicians, there's plenty of them, they're all quick to remind everybody that the attack by Hamas militants on Israelis was the deadliest attack against Jews since the Holocaust. For members of the media and the mainstream press and alternative spheres, it's clear that most journalists and media pundits have been actively repeating this grab bag of Israeli claims about what they believe happened during the Palestinian resistance operation known as Al-Aqsa Flood and Israel's ruthless response to it. So several of these long-held assumptions, and there are many, about the Israeli military intelligence institutions were shattered that day, about the invincibility of its military, shattered that day, about the competence of the Israeli state, totally shattered. The idea that intelligence agencies like Mossad and Shin Bet were omnipotent, all-seeing, all-knowing, the world's finest, completely eviscerated that Saturday morning in Gaza. And the other idea that fell apart was the perception of the invincibility of their deterrent strategy, the great deterrent strategy of Israel. This prison break by the Palestinian resistance from the Gaza Strip would redefine any future negotiations with Israel and the native Palestinian population. And so they have. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the truth of the matter. But we're only scratching the surface. And perhaps in subsequent episodes, we'll bring on experts who have actually done investigations into these very facts to expose what really happened on that day. And it's important to know what happened, because the reaction by the Israeli state, by the United States, by their allies, are all based on beliefs or assumptions of what they believe, quote, Hamas carried out on October 7th. And they're justifying the very genocide which is in the dock right now in the International Courts of Justice in The Hague. So this isn't trivial. This goes to the heart of the whole matter, and it goes to the heart of all the policies that have been lined up one after the other over the last 6 months. Because when you take away all these assumptions about what you think happened, it completely transforms the present. And you then have to reevaluate everything that's going on right now. Could Israel or the Israeli leadership could they have led their own population up the garden path through this propaganda operation to rile them up, to get them to hate the native population, to back what is effectively an ethnic cleansing campaign and a genocide underway? That's the big question. See, that's the question that history is going to ask. And rather than wait 20 years, why don't we figure it out now? Instead of like 9/11 or JFK, be arguing over the minutiae of this in 20 or 30 years time. I don't think so. I don't think the world can wait. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for joining us this week. It's been a fantastic and powerful week of broadcasting. Thank you to Sam Husseini today. Thank you to Syrian Girl and Yusuf Mowry, award-winning journalist from Yemen, all of our contributors, and to you, our audience, for joining us. This has been a powerful week. Hopefully we'll be able to do it again for you next week. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Take care, you guys. Have a great weekend.